everyone. So I just want to remind you that we created a Patreon page. That's Patreon. And you just go to patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. You can donate $8 per episode, which would hopefully get me back to 2 fresh episodes a week. And I know that you've learned from this podcast. I know it gives out great value. And so if you want to see it keep going and share it with other people, I could really use your help just paying the basics. You know, cost me at least $100 to keep this show up on the internet for hosting and the website and the calendar and just all the things that help keep it going together. There's also the Green Future Grower Book Club if you're interested in joining that for $10 a month, which would be amazing. We're going to go through books like the Elia Coleman, New Organic Gardener, or Jean Martin Fortier's Market Gardener book, or Lisa Ziegler's Cool Flowers. There's the John Jevons book, the Floret, or Lynn Bazinski's flower books. Like, I already love the humus one. I think I'll do a much better job with this study group. So once a month, we'll be picking a different book and we can talk about how it relates to your garden. Only $10 a month to join that. We'll meet on a Zoom or a Google Hangout, and it will be just an amazing extended learning section. So I know I haven't done much to promote this, but please support our Patreon page at patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. That's patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. Hey there, Green Future Growers. Thanks for joining us today. If you're new to the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or your favorite Android app, and let's get growing. Let me see. So do you have a copy of the questions I usually ask?
I can get them up my computer.
Okay, well, just, they're just there for you to kind of follow along if you want them, or if you're not worried about it, I'm not worried about it.
No, I'm a better walker and talker, so I'm gonna be in my garden while we talk.
Oh, awesome!
That'll,
I love that. Lucky,
keep me inspired.
Cool, that's awesome, and I guess I would love to be able to do that, but I can't get a signal down in my garden. I wish when we got these new phones, they gave you I wish I would have bought a booster. Because, I could have got that instead of paying the activation fees, but I was just in such a hurry, and I wish I would have, because all summer I've been like, I wish I could just do Facebook Live, and then it would just be done instead of, always having to upload the videos. And
oh, my gosh. The workflows of all this stuff. I know, because I run an online school, and we have live webinars and coaching calls every week, and same thing. Like, man, I gotta be sitting in my office, to do it all.
The one thing I am really digging is this new Instagram TV. That is cool, and they let you upload videos up to 10 minutes. So,
oh really? Wow,
that's huge.
That's like through a business Facebook, Instagram business account or something.
I don't know. My accounts are business accounts.
Yeah.
They just came out with it in June. So it's really new. And you actually have to download. I think you have to download a different app. I'm not even sure. I know on the iPad,
right,
I had to download a different app. But when I first got on it on my phone, I could just do it from the regular Instagram app on my phone. But
right
now I ended up downloading the Instagram app. And I don't think you can watch it on a laptop or a computer. I haven't figured out a way to do that yet. But it's so much easier than YouTube. It's so much easier than anywhere else. And I just happen to have made 700 videos this summer. Not as much for my – half of them are probably for my gardening people. But a lot of them, I'm starting this new business about teaching kids to read. And a lot of them are there, and they just happen, I go through these specific lessons, and the lessons run, 2 to 3 minutes per task, kind of, and it comes out to, a 20-minute lesson after you do all 5 tasks. So it's perfect for that. I don't know how many kids are on Instagram, but, Sesame Street
right
has a huge channel, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood has a huge channel, and I kind of call it Mr. Rogers meets Sesame Street and the Common Core at your local library. That's kind of my description for what it would be like.
Nice.
So, I don't know.
That's a good feeling. That's a good vibe.
Does it?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I don't know. I just happen to have these puppets, and for some reason, I'm like compelled to teach my puppets to read, and that's where it's going to, going from, kind of. So I don't know. Anyway, it's all a complete work in progress. And then I've had all these computer challenges this summer, which hopefully I have finally. I mean, really, the biggest challenge was like my plug-in to my MacBook. Kind of like was down to like the fine hair, you know, like every time I plugged it in, I was like, is this gonna be the last 3 hours I get to run it? And then, because that's about how long my battery lasts. Anyway,
man,
I finally broke
down and bought a plug-in. You sound like me. You have lots of projects and ideas, and you just keep going, and then you figure it out as you go. That's how I do it.
Exactly. So I'm gonna write a book called Polish Your Shiny Penny someday about, like, because, like, I always feel like my Organic Garden podcast is kind of a shiny penny that I love. I mean, my listeners are amazing. I've learned a ton. They're so inspiring. My guests, like you, are awesome. I mean, what a shiny penny to polish. But I think this teaching thing is going to be the end all. So, and you might want to be on it at some point, because it's actually, I just launched, it's called the Authentic Teacher Podcast, and I see that you do a lot of teaching. I was just trying to download your book about the forest fires onto my Kindle.
Oh,
at least a sample of it, and that's kind of right where I was when I was like, all right, I gotta log in. But I love your website. Your guys' photography is just stunning. So I think listeners are gonna love looking at your website. And I mean, I don't know, the composition for them and the coloring, and it's so inspiring. I loved your website going through it this morning.
Thank you. Yeah, it's funny. A couple of years ago, I decided that, you know, if we're going to have pictures, I want them to be high quality pictures in good light, good color. And I got, like, you know, a nice camera. And so I've been doing that and learning about the time of day. You know, it's always like end of the day is when I go out and take all my photos. But then I've gotten flack from people in the online world who are like, why are you using Shutterstock photos? You should be using your own photos. And I'm like, hey, you know,
those,
I guess that's an
photos.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. It's like, actually, that's my daughter actually in that picture. Those are my photos.
That is awesome. I love
that.
That's
a funny compliment
so cool.
to get, you know? You're like,
yeah.
Okay, actually, they are mine. And shoot, I hope people don't think that, you know, like...
Maybe
you better
start selling your photos.
Yeah, exactly. I'll start putting my photos.
Another
down,
rabbit hole to go down, right?
Right.
I thought about that in the beginning. I was like, what could I offer on the Organic Garden podcast? I'm like, well, I have like thousands of pictures. I could be like, go get our Shutterstock. But I could never figure out how to make that work. Like, free garden Shutterstock. I kept thinking that would be something I could sell, because I still have yet to come up with a product for the Organic Garden podcast. Really, I mean, I kind of made a garden journal, but that's kind of been that's also a work in progress.
Right. Well, it's the kind of thing where you'll catch up with yourself someday. You know, it all takes time, and then little by little, you'll have your journal, and then, you know, you'll think of the next thing. And man, I mean, there's stuff that I've been trying to get done for the last year that I just finally got done in the last like 2 weeks, that I'd started and didn't have time. But then it feels so good when you finally complete it and you get it off your plate. And it's like, okay, now that's in my ecosystem of offerings.
But I also, like, I totally feel a kindred spirit with you. Feel like you can't rush. Like, if I would have started and tried to build my authentic teacher thing back in 2014 when I launched the Organic Gardener podcast, I would not have had what I needed. Like, I needed to teach second grade. I needed to teach fourth grade. Up until then, I had mostly just been in kindergarten and first. And I needed to go back to school and teach those other grades to see where the kids need to get to in the upper levels. So I always feel like it's got to be the right time. It's kind of like Steve Jobs and his connecting the dots.
Totally. Oh, I totally agree with you. Yeah, there's stuff that I want to do that I know I need about a year or two more before I'll be ready. And
my thing is, I don't always know that I need more, and I think I'm ready, and then I jump into it, and then I'm not ready. So good for you. I mean, there's something.
Well, that's the learning process, right? That's what happened to me beginning of last year. I have all these short online courses that I'm working on with partners. And at the beginning of last year, I'm like, all right, you know, I reached out to all these partners and like, we're going to do these 10, you know, short courses together. And you know, like now this is 9 months later and we almost have one of them done, you know, it was like, okay, maybe it's going to take us a few years to build up to this many short courses. Cause that's a lot of work and you're herding cats, you know, with getting, as you probably know, getting these leadership folks on board and activated and working with their schedules and everything.
Herding cats. Everything,
yeah.
I hear you. I've heard people talk about teaching that way too, describing following kindergartners as herding cats. So I definitely understand that. And like I tried, like I'm in exactly that same space. So last winter I came home for Christmas break and my husband and I, like, I don't know why, like driving home that Friday night, I could like hear the chapters of this course in my head. Like I could see the table of contents and we spent that whole 2 weeks banging out the first 5 lessons. And then I thought this summer I'm going to do lessons 6 through 12 and we're going to have, you know, one episode a month. And I went to New York to visit my mom and we spent like an entire day tearing apart the first part of lesson 1. And I just kind of am stuck there. And so lessons 1 through 5 are still kind of in the phase of working on them. And 6 through 12, I'm exactly in the same boat. So I'm glad to hear it's not just me.
No, it takes its own time, right? We can be excited, but then reality takes over and you want to do it right. And then it'll just be whatever it is.
I totally agree. And doing it right is like another thing. Like I finally signed up for, do you know who Amy Porterfield is?
The name sounds familiar.
She teaches like how to teach an online course. And that has been huge for me. Like watching her slides and having her teach you how to break it down and do everything step by step. Cause that was the biggest thing. My mom was like, she's like, you need to like, you have way too much information. She's like, you have to back up and like slow, like take this step by step. She's like, just like your lesson one could be like 10 lessons. Cause my lesson one was like composting and soil health and cover crops and this and that. And she's like, no, just do compost and just do one part of it. She's like, you don't even explain to anybody how to like take the compost container and walk it out to the compost bin and like dump it. She's like, you need to show that part, like every little step. She's like, you don't have a picture of anybody cutting up the food on a cutting board and like putting those. And then we were arguing about that. Should we put a tomato that's like got mold on it that went bad in the fridge in there or not? Anyway, let's get into, because we've been like 11 minutes
Sounds
and
good.
We're still in the pre-chat, which I might just leave in there because one, it will get it up quicker. And two, listeners might be interested, but do you have any questions? I always tell people it's really easy to edit. So like if you need to let the dog out or you're already in your garden, cool. But if you need to like change an answer, think about something, it's super easy to edit. Of course, the less edits we have to do, the sooner it gets on the air.
Totally. So
I'll just introduce you kind of late and we'll go from there.
Okay. Yeah, perfect.
Okay, cool. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. Today is Tuesday, September 4th, 2018. And I have an amazing, possibly rock star millennial on the line. His name's Eric Olson from the Permaculture Skills Center. So welcome to the show, Eric.
Oh, thank you. So happy to be here. And I'm not quite millennial material. I'm sort of the XY generation, just before millennial, so a little older.
Okay, cool. I have a thing for millennials, but I also like a lot of my guests are our age too. My mom's always like, "Quit talking about the millennials," and I think my husband kind of feels that way too. So, anyway, we're all good. Go ahead and tell listeners a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you. So Eric Olson, director of the Permaculture Skills Center and also the principal of Permaculture Artisans, which is a landscape design and contracting company that focuses on regenerative design, landscape restoration, water harvesting systems, and everything under the sun that related to permaculture. And I've been doing this work since I was 19, so this is really my entire adult life. I've been in the ecological design, permaculture, regenerative agriculture realm. I've worked with hundreds of clients, mostly in California. And have kind of experienced a whole variety of how to apply principles and take action and build community through nonprofit organizations, through small business organizing, through grassroots activism, through education and working in schools. So I've had an opportunity to really dabble in a lot of different angles to regenerating our planet, building community.
Awesome. This is fantastic. And just like you haven't heard the pre-chat, I talked about his website is just full of information and amazing photographs. And I know you're going to be inspired as he drops, I'm sure, tons of golden seeds. Kelly Ware is still showing up as like one of my most downloaded guests, most read pages. And she talked about permaculture. I know it's something people are really interested in, and especially with all the fires and the floods and everything, people are getting more interested in regenerative agriculture and everything that you've got going there. So, and on the flip side, the majority of my listeners are in California, so I'm sure it's going to be relevant to them. So,
absolutely.
I do kind of always start the show asking about, like, what was your very first gardening experience? You know, were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Have you always been doing this?
I have two answers to that. So my first answer is when I was a kid, my grandparents, they lived in Santa Barbara, and I would spend the summers there. And I remember one summer going out into the garden with my grandma Marie. And one of the things she always used to do was she would, and that wasn't something that my family did.
But wait, I lost that. She what?
She buried her kitchen compost in her garden. That was how she handled her kitchen compost. And I was always the, you know, her little helper. So I remember going out with her and digging holes. And she'd bury her compost. And then she planted mostly tomatoes was what she grew the most of. And so I remember helping her with her compost and then helping harvest tomatoes out of her garden that we ate for lunch. And that was probably the first time as a kid that I made that connection between being able to grow your own food right in your own backyard, and how the colors and the flavors were so superior to any other food you could get anywhere else.
That's so fascinating. My mom, I just have to tell you this super quick. My mom's name is Marie, so she's Grandma Marie or Grammy Marie. She also buries her compost directly in the backyard. Like, she takes it right out of the container and just digs a hole and buries it right then and there. She doesn't really deal with the whole compost pile thing. I think that's so fascinating.
That is so fascinating. Maybe it's like an older generation thing, too, that's been passed down, because it seemed very intuitive to my grandma that this is the way you do it. So that's my first kind of memory. But my first real gardening experience was when I was 19 years old. I started an organization with friends that we called Planting Earth Activation. And we started this organization because we kind of woke up to the realities around genetically modified organisms, Monsanto. And at that point, Monsanto had come out with this Terminator seed technology, which was they would sell seed to a farmer. The farmer would grow that seed out, but those plants were genetically engineered not to produce more seed, so they were sterile. And in learning about this and the potential of that pollen getting out to the natural environment and wreaking havoc on our biosphere, myself and a bunch of my friends got together and was like, we have to respond somehow. And so we, you know, after staying up late at night after night, we came up with this idea that we were going to give gardens away to our community and save open pollinated and heirloom seeds. So my first big gardening experience, and some of us had experience, some of us didn't, and I didn't have much experience at that time, was we went down to the community garden in our hometown of Sebastopol, California, and we got a big plot down there that we were able to garden in, and we had our first big garden party. And we had about 30 people come out, friends and people in the community, and we built this huge garden together in one day. And that probably is an important moment in my life where I experienced not only what it was like to work in the earth and grow my own food, but to do it in a community setting within the purpose of kind of responding to this greater catastrophe, you know, that the earth was facing. And that for us, the heirloom seed garden was the solution to so many things.
Nice. Oh my gosh. I bet you're inspiring listeners. I call my listeners green future growers because I feel like we're all kind of growing a greener future. And I bet some of them are going to go out and be like, I'm starting a community garden. I'm going to help grow heirloom seeds and give away a garden in my neighborhood today.
I sure hope so, because it can be a life-changing experience. That organization, Planting Earth Activation, we planted over 200 community gardens over a 2.5-year period.
Oh my goodness.
It was absolutely incredible. And some in our community now, there are some areas when we eventually kind of went from annual seed gardens to planting more perennial systems, and there's still fruit and nut trees and herbal gardens in our, like literally in our downtown district that we planted way back when. So the legacy lives on.
Aww. I'd like to make a children's book about you. I love all of this. And I'm so excited to read. What is your book called? It's Forests of Fire, or what is it?
So I have a few children's books and a couple coloring books. But I have one that's called Forest of Fire. And this is a children's book that is also appropriate for adults. And this book goes through the stages of a pristine forest that has a beneficial relationship with fire, fire ecology, that this forest goes through the experience of having humans move on, clear cut, build their homes. And we talk about in the book the different scales of fire relative to a healthy fire that you would imagine any fire ecology versus a catastrophic fire, which deeply impacts communities and the environment. And so it's really a book about teaching children and adults about fire ecology.
Cool. Does it have like solutions for like what? It's so interesting because, you know, here I am up in the big logging community in Northwest Montana, and like I've been kind of like trying to stay out of it. But Mike like pointed out this person's post the other day about someone complaining that the environmentalists shut all the forests down and we're having all these huge catastrophic fires and it's all the environmentalists' fault. And of course, I got into it with her and I was like, what, you don't believe in science? Like, here's the science. And she's like, no, I don't believe that. That's when I quit. I was like, okay, but do you have anything to say about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, here's the thing is that much of the population around planet Earth lives in fire ecologies, and fire ecologies are ecosystems that depend on fire for their health and vitality. So they need fire to eradicate disease, to cycle nutrients, to even activate the native seeds. There are so many native seeds in fire ecologies that actually require heat in order to be viable. So you have tens of thousands of years, potentially maybe even millions of years of evolution in these natural ecosystems where a system is in relationship with fire. But what we really have to point out is that it's not only the evolution, you know, from a strictly non-human point of view, but indigenous communities have been using fire in these environments for tens of thousands of years. And so the ecology evolves with the management regime. So what we do have, and I wouldn't 100% disagree with the person that you know, I don't know what her take on it was, but there is something to be said about what I would call a conservationist environmentalist approach, which came out of the 1970s, and that has had some detrimental effects to our ability to manage. But that's very, you know, to unpack that is a pretty big deal, because it's not to say we should go in and log the forest. That's totally not the solution. But we do need to think about ecosystems holistically, and specifically we need to look at ecosystems through the lens of management. And if you look back to any environment, say the forest in Montana, over the past 10,000 years, what kind of management did that forest evolve with? Was it fire? Was there big animals that are no longer there? What kind of management regime did it evolve with? Because here in California, I can tell you that the indigenous people have always used fire as a management tool. And we also have had antelope, elk, and bear, who are all big animals that play a role in disturbance. And so I think this is a good time to say regenerative disturbance is really what we're talking about here. What kinds of disturbance or management regimes do these ecosystems require in order to stay healthy? And one of the issues we've had is the fire suppression campaign over the last 100 years, which is that we're going to squelch any fire that comes up. And we've put too much emphasis on fighting fire in response to catastrophic fire than we have on actually using fire in a prescribed fashion, allowing fires to burn where they don't threaten human health and safety. And so it's a very complex issue. And one of the things that happened in the 1970s during the environmental conservationist movement was this notion of don't touch nature. Like, let nature be, don't touch nature, don't let your cows in there, don't ever cut a thing, nothing. And unfortunately, that has taken the management, it's taken the relationship out. Whereas these ecosystems evolved with relationship with humans, evolved through relationship with big animals, which maybe aren't there anymore. And so it's not really a surprise that we're seeing the kind of fuel load, the dry, dead material in these ecosystems that go up, that burn up really fast. No surprise that we're seeing that, because there's been little to no management in these ecosystems. So it's a very complex topic to try to unpack, because folks like who support, clear cutting and major logging are going to sort of track to this conversation about sustainable thinning as a means to potentially increase logging production. But that's not necessarily the solution, although sustainable thinning is a solution if done with the integrity of the whole forest in mind. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And that's what I told her. I was like, I'm not against logging altogether. I'm not a fan of clear cutting. Actually, it's so funny because my husband and I got in the biggest screaming fight at each other the very first day we met. Like, he said he knew he was in love with me and wanted to marry me that day over this same exact fight, because I was like, we can't cut anything and they've already cut too many trees. And he's like, you environmentalists ruin this place because you shut down places where they should be cutting down trees. Like, if a lodgepole beetle came in and all the lodgepole were already dead anyway and getting that fuel out of there. And he's like, and then you're letting them cut these giant green trees that we don't need to be cutting. And I think that's the key, is sustainable management. And that's what I was like, sustainable logging, I'm all for it. I don't want to see, like, all these places. Like, I'm not even sure about wilderness if you're going to have your... There's so many places around here. Like, the thing that kills me is there's so many places that say old growth, where you can't even go get firewood. And there's just tons of giant dead trees. And they're right on the highway, so people will see those old growth signs. I'm like, here's a highway. Obviously, it's not old growth. This is the same forest on this side of the highway as on that side of the highway. And just anyway, we're here to talk about gardening.
Yeah. I'll just say one more thing on that.
Okay.
I think what it ultimately comes down to is the whole issue is about the human relationship with the natural world. And I think we need to understand that we need to have an intentional relationship with our environment. We need to have our hands and our feet and our hearts in the forest, in the meadows, in the grasslands, in the mountains, and the ocean. But we need to do it within a framework of what benefits all of life. So if when we relate to our natural ecosystems with tools and with intention, if we do it within, what's the holistic view? What's the multi-generational view of how this ecosystem can thrive, then we may track towards the kinds of management techniques and relationship that actually benefits both humans and the land, which gardening is one of those solutions.
Awesome. That is a perfect way to transition. So do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Something that grew out this year?
Grew well this year? Something that's going
good? Oh, grew well this year. Yeah. Yep. Oh, my goodness.
You Since you're down in your garden, tell us.
I'm in my garden right now.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at an Asian pear that is, we are having an Asian pear bumper crop. Like, we have so many Asian pears. I mean, we're eating too many. We're giving them away as fast as we can. But they are the juiciest, yummiest. There's a four-year-old tree. So my homestead, I live on a one-acre homestead, and we've been here 4 years. We've planted 90 fruit trees and nut trees. We have a quarter-acre vegetable garden, and everything else is layered with medicinal herbs and habitat plants and such. And so now that we're 4 years into it, all the trees we planted are really coming into maturity. And it is just every day is like the harvest experience of a lifetime. My daughter, who's 8, I have a son who's 10 as well. My daughter, who's 8, she comes out in the garden and she just explores and finds all the new fruits and all the new flowers. But lately it's been the Asian pears that are you know, standing out in the garden. I wish I could give you one right now so you could taste it.
Yum. We're having a good pear year, too. We have one tree that's never produced a pear that they're like these itty bitty miniature pears, like the size of, oh my gosh, they're not even as big as a lemon. I mean, they are just tiny, but they're really good. And then our other pear tree that has produced pears, it has like 2 dozen pears on it. I can't wait to eat them. They're so close to being ripe. And then we also have a plum tree that's finally going to hopefully produce. I mean, they're like turning purple. I can't wait any day. Mike says as soon as it freezes, hopefully they're not going to die before them. Sorry, what about the pears?
I was asking, those little ones, are they the seckle pear?
I just think I think they're supposed to be regular like Bartlett's, and I think they just didn't grow very. We didn't have a lot of water. My husband and I are very, our water's really restricted, and so I think they just didn't have a lot of water. I don't know.
Gotcha.
I don't think they're supposed to be miniature.
We have a seckle pear, which is just coming on right now, also called the honey pear. And those are some of the best flavor you can eat, you know, fresh eating. But they're small. They don't get bigger than, they don't get too much bigger than like a golf ball size. So they're really small, but they're really packed with flavor.
That's kind of that's what these are, like a golf ball almost, like that on the bottom and then just the itty bitty tip on top. I don't know, truth be told, I mean, we planted this tree in 2012 and this is the first year it's ever put out pears, so I'd have to go back and look and see what kind of pear it is supposed to be.
All right, well, hey, it's coming on, and you never know year to year what, like this year in California, Northern California at least, many of our peaches and nectarines really didn't do well at all. We got that wrong time storm during flowering, and we had hardly any harvest on our peaches and nectarines. But last year it was the bumper crop. So it's like year to year, you never know, just with the little climate changes and what may happen with storm systems and timing, or what may happen with frost. It's always a mystery what's going to do great and what's going to suffer year to year.
Absolutely. I think that will encourage new listener or new gardeners who are listening that, you know, it's just always, you never know what's going to happen for sure. So how about, is there something new or different you're excited to try that you tried maybe this year that you're excited to try next year?
Well, one thing are the, a lot of what we do are perennial based. And so, a lot of it, like there's a persimmon, a new persimmon, that is finally doing well this year. I'm very excited. This will be our first year that we have a real crop on it. We never had a good persimmon crop. So I'm very excited for that. And of course, we have to wait until November for those. So, but they're already swollen and the trees are bending over. We're propping the trees up. So it's going to be a good persimmon year. I'm really quite excited about that. In the veggie garden, one of the things that's just been, I've grown this year after year, but the last few years we didn't grow it. And this year is really going off are the lemon cucumbers. Mm-hmm. And we've really rediscovered our love of lemon cucumbers, for fresh cucumber eating.
And what makes, I don't know if I just lost my mic. What makes, a lemon cucumber different than a regular cucumber?
So they are circular rather than oblong. So they're round balls and they're bright yellow. They literally look just like a lemon. And they produce like crazy. Oh boy. Yeah. See if you can get some seed and grow them out, because when it comes to fresh eating cucumbers, I think they win it for us. Well, other than the Armenian cucumbers, actually, I think we like those a little better, but the lemon cucumbers are, the best cucumber we have in the garden this year. You know, at any stage you can eat it and it tastes good. And then, like I said, you know, they're just so interesting because they're these like yellow lemon looking things. But you cut into it and it's just so crisp and flavorful. And man, they outproduce every other cucumber, like time and time again. It's amazing. Right now I have lemon cukes and we planted maybe 3 plants and they've now, let's see, I'm sitting here looking at them right now. They've taken about they've grown about 10 or 12 feet long, and then they've sprawled off the bed down into this rain garden another 10 feet. So it's like a 10 by 10 patch off 2 plants. And they're just, every day we could harvest a basket of them.
So when you say that, does that mean like there's a vine that's going down that 10 feet and then there's cucumbers coming off of all the vines?
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know if you can hear it, but like it's like echoing in my ear. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. No, I don't hear it.
I don't know why it's doing that. It's like every time I talk, there's like a delay behind me.
Oh, I hate that. You sound good. You sound good on my end.
Okay, good. Well, tell us about something that didn't work so well or didn't go out the way you thought it was.
Well, one of our big issues here are gophers. And so that's one of that is probably the biggest challenge. And we were so excited to have a pepper crop this year. My daughter loves fresh peppers, sweet peppers. And so we spent a lot of time prepping our bed, the pepper bed, and choosing varieties and planting them out. And we have kind of made a mistake because the way that we grow, it's very intensive. We let a lot of things go to seed. And so that means that all of our beds are going to grow, you know, lots of diversity in them without anything. So we planted our pepper bed into one of these beds that has, you know, all kinds of other stuff that wants to come up. And so we prepped the bed, we picked our peppers, we planted them out. And then two things happened. One, we went on vacation for like a week and came back, and a lot of the, you know, quote unquote weeds or other plants that were there kind of grew up and shaded the peppers a little bit. And that stressed them out. And then of course, the gophers started sucking them down. And now we literally have, out of 20 pepper plants that we planted, we have 2 left. Just hanging on. One of them actually got hit by the gopher, but then kind of somehow stayed alive and is bent over in the pathway. And so that's been kind of a bummer, losing the peppers. We haven't quite figured peppers out for our area. We're pretty coastal. We're about 8 miles from the coast. And our summers are pretty foggy. This summer especially has been foggy. So, man, the peppers, they're not really working in this garden.
Hmm. I can feel your pain. We've been through that before too. And we're struggling with things growing, trees growing so tall, places where we've planted tomatoes and peppers before. I can just tell they're not getting enough sun. Mike's like, "Well, we just need to cut those trees down." I was like, "Maybe we could move the beds."
Cut the trees down, move the beds. Ooh, yeah. If you have the space.
He always wants to expand. Let's move it. And I'm like, we have too much space. We can't water what we have.
Right. Well, one of the things we do with our trees, interestingly enough, because while I have good water on my site, I work with a lot of clients that have hardly any water. So there's all kinds of solutions with water catchment and infiltration and all this stuff. But one of the things we do is we try to get all of our trees dry farmed if we can. And so essentially what we do is we water them for the first 3 years. And we use thick mulch, and we usually plant them somewhere where winter rains can infiltrate around them. And then after 3 years, we take them off irrigation. And that opens up our water budget or a client's water budget to then expand and use that water budget for a new system. So that's an interesting way. It does result in some dead trees that can't handle being dry farmed, but those are just kind of self-selected out then for a system that doesn't work on low water.
I don't think any of our trees would make it. They're so dry. And like you can
They're
see their
already dry
leaves
farmed.
like, what is it, like, folding up and kind of getting spots on them. And I can just see the stress on, and we only have nine fruit trees maybe. And they need more water. I don't know how you dry farm a tree.
Yeah, well, the way you dry farm a tree is you water very infrequently, but you water very deep. So you get them to you get them you train them so their roots will go down really far. So you can't really pamper them too much. And then it's a slow process of taking them off. And that's not to say that we don't in a because we're in a drought, and if we have a really hot summer, I'm definitely going to give those trees some water if they look stressed, if I can. But after a few years, and it's also because we focus so much on building the topsoil, it's a combination of focusing on topsoil, on building topsoil, focusing on concentrating rain and surface water flow to the orchard in the winter so that we increase the water lens and water holding capacity of the soil there near the trees. And then infrequent watering, but really deep watering that helps them get their roots down. And that can work for many species of trees, but it doesn't work for everything. So that's our method that has had moderate success in our area.
And do you have to do that right when they're babies and they're young? Like we needed to do that when we first planted them?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think it would take some time to train them to get their roots to go down farther. So if it were me, I would probably take another 2 years to try to retrain them a little bit that way, just with the watering frequency and just kind of ease them into a new pattern. Because if we change pattern too fast, then things get shocked because they're used to, it's kind of like if you are used to sleeping 8 hours a night and then all of a sudden you're only sleeping 6 hours a night. You can't make that adjustment right away. And so for the water, for the trees, you need to ease them into that. But yeah, I think you would be able to get them trained over time
And I don't know that. I mean, because like when I water them, what I do is I try to take 10 gallons of water. So I'll take a 5 gallon bucket, fill it up, dump it on the tree, do that twice. And I try to do that once a week. I don't know if that counts as deep watering.
Well, that's pretty good. Successionally, though, what you would do as each year as you, is that you would water them even less frequently than that. So maybe you would go to once every 2 weeks, but even a little bit deeper. And then you would move into maybe once a month. So that's how you would do it, is you would train them by slowly taking more time in between. But of course, you want to have your trees be healthy and thrive and produce fruit and all that. So if they look super stressed, you might want to give them more water. I think it's the kind of thing you start in the springtime, as you move into, you know, when you have a lot of moisture available already. And then as you move into the warm season, you kind of, you start the cycle then, and do that for a couple of years and see if you can get to once a month watering and do 20 gallons once a month. Something like that might be a solution, but it all depends on the context. I don't know enough about your climate and your soils to make a, you know, an exact recommendation there. But what you're doing sounds really good already.
Yeah, I mean, that's all we pretty much do. Mike sometimes will run the sprinkler out there once a week, too. But pretty much, yeah. And I haven't even watered them consistently once a week, to be honest.
Oh, and I would say, you know,
stressed.
I would say sprinklers are the, you don't generally want to do sprinklers with trees, because sprinklers more just
yeah,
water the
no,
top.
He just does that to kind of keep the lawn in the orchard area green.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Not.
Yeah, I mean,
but at least it's not fire. We kind of keep the fire, you know, our big thing is keep that fire barrier around the house, the lawn, just enough to keep it green-ish.
That's a good idea. Well, and the other thing you might think about that we do, especially in more dry land situations, is we'll actually bury a pipe next to the tree at the time of planting. So it might be like a 3-foot pipe, 2 or 3 inches in diameter. And we bury it next to the tree. And we might put a little bit of gravel on the bottom. And when we water directly into the pipe. And the pipe is perforated. But you water into the pipe, and what that does is it gets the water down into those deeper roots and allows so that this whole surface area, like the top 18 inches, you know, can absorb a ton of water, and maybe the water doesn't even get down deep if you're not doing long, deep watering. Because we often use drip system, and we may water for an hour straight on one tree once a month. But if you're hand watering, you can bury pipes, these pipes along with the trees, and then get that deep watering that way. And that's a nice way to help train the tree to go down with their roots.
Ooh, I like that. Mike said something to me about doing, like, I don't know if it was putting like a water bottle or a Pepsi bottle or something full of water to leak in there. And it might have been like my tomato plants. I can't even remember.
Yeah, there's these things called the Oya pots. Which is, I think, that same idea, which is basically a clay pot that you bury next to your plant and you fill it with water, and then water slowly leaks out of the pot over a long period of time. So it's like a little bit of water at a time, but it keeps the area moist day after day after day. And that's a really great, another good dry land technique, for conserving water. And then also it reduces evaporation because it's in this clay pot. So sun and wind aren't going to evaporate it out as fast. So it's a similar kind of idea. Like if you had a water jug or plastic bottle or something, and you just had a tiny hole in it and you filled it and put it next to your plant, it would just be a very slow drip. I love those cool do-it-yourself methods.
Mm-hmm. Me too. So this is actually where we get to the part of the show called getting to the root of things, which are kind of like quicker answers.
Okay.
Or just like, you know, some people call it lightning round.
Let's do it. I'm ready.
Do you have a least favorite activity in the garden? Like something you got to force yourself to go do?
Trapping gophers.
Mm-hmm. Trapping gophers.
Yep.
And you know, that has been a huge problem on my show. And we had a big problem with voles last year. I just took a video of Mike yesterday saying, "You're not having as big of a problem with voles this year yet." And he said, "Well, they got the carrots and the beans, but they're not into the potatoes as much." So definitely, critters is a struggle.
Yeah.
So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity?
My favorite activity is what I would call chop and drop. And that's where I come out, and our garden's really intensive. And like I said, a lot of it is perennial edibles, perennial vegetables and fruit and nuts and stuff. But we grow a lot of biomass plants as part of our soil building, our soil building endeavor here. So chop and drop is coming out and cutting back the biomass plants and then placing them back down on the ground as mulch. So it's kind of like an in-place composting system in a perennial food forest type area, or type setup. So that's definitely one of my favorites because I love harvesting biomass because I know that I'm feeding the soil, and I try not to bring in mulch and compost from offsite. I like to limit the amount of material I bring in from offsite. So I try to grow all of my biomass needs and all my garden's biomass needs on site. And then this is one of our methods for returning it to the soil.
Okay, so can I ask you a question? I For the first time I planted buckwheat. And it's blooming like crazy. And it's just starting to form those pretty red seeds. And I planted it as a cover crop for biomass. But I'm not sure when do I cut it? I feel like I should be cutting it. I shouldn't be letting it go to those red seeds. But I can't bring
Agreed.
myself to do that.
I know, right? Well, you get another amazing harvest if you let it go to just go to seed. But yeah, generally you want to cut cover crops down when they're flowering. So you might be just like a little bit late on that. But if it's still sort of in that mid stage of flowering and just starting to produce some seed, you might consider cutting down a portion of it. I like to save, if I can, I like to leave cover crops, especially. About 30% I like to leave for seed so that I can save the seed and have them for the next cycle. And then the other 70% I chop and integrate back into the garden.
Okay, and so then when I chop it, like just cut it into 6-inch pieces or something, and then let it lay there, or I turn it into the dirt.
I guess it depends on sort of what your style is, what you want to achieve out of it. Definitely don't pull it up, right? So leave the root systems in the ground to decompose. That's the first important thing. So cut it at the base, and then you can either take that material and broad fork it into the ground or double dig if you use that method, or some people will take that and then compost that and turn their bed into, prep it for the next round of seeds or something. Or the third way is cut it at the base, lay it right on the site, and then you want to put some other kind of mulch, just like a little bit on top of that. Maybe it's other biomass that you put over, or it's straw or something. Just because the one issue with the chop and drop method is, especially with nitrogen fixers like that buckwheat, is that when you lay it on the ground, if you don't cover it with anything, then a lot of it just oxidizes and just kind of off gases, and you don't actually capture a lot of the material, which is why a lot of folks actually integrate it into the soil. But when we integrate it into the soil, of course, we bring tillage into the mix, which has its place, but does also release a lot of carbon to the atmosphere. So kind of just depending on what your goals are for that bed in that area, you might just chop it, just lay it right on the ground. And then put a little straw or leaves or something like that over it, wet it down so it holds moisture, and then all that buckwheat should decompose right there and feed the worms and everything.
I want in one of the beds, I want to put raspberry starts or
Oh,
whatever they
nice.
are.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would just cut it and leave it then, and put another kind of mulch over the top of it. Just let it decompose. Raspberries like a lot of, but they like a lot of organic matter. And they like thick mulch, and they also will just do awesome, in that kind of situation. So the other nice thing about when you do a chop and drop kind of method like that is it really saves you on labor. And that's one of the reasons why I love it, because I'll walk through the garden and I'm not like carrying biomass around with me. I'm not making compost with it. If I'm doing this method, it's like I leave everything where I cut it. And I just love that idea of being able to keep nutrients right where they grew.
Me too. It's so pretty too. I just feel like it's like the only thing we have for the bees right now. Like there's so many flowers blooming.
Well, that's an important consideration. Definitely. Yeah. That's why it's like, it's all about context, you know?
Yeah. But I have two beds of it, so I might cut the one where I want to put the raspberries and let the other one go to seed.
That's a great idea. And then the bees can enjoy it until it goes to seed, and then you have a nice seed harvest for the next round.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so what's the best gardening advice you have ever received?
Don't overthink it. Don't overthink it. Avoid paralysis by analysis. And what that means is, there's kind of like two camps of gardener folks. There's the folks who are like really into the science and do everything based off of scientific data and everything. And then there are the folks who just go and experiment and kind of ignore the science and just kind of see what works and then repeat what works. I'm kind of more in the latter. Even though I've read and learned from scientists and such, my approach is, and this is what I was taught when I was in my early 20s, is just constantly experiment. Keep planting, keep putting seeds in the ground. Throwing, organic matter on the ground and growing stuff and cutting it back, composting it. I like to do a lot of experiments. And so people go in my gardens and it's like jaw dropping. It's so green and abundant and everything seems so happy. And it's just my mad scientist going for it. And one of the issues I see a lot is that people think they're going to mess up. So, I didn't want to plant my tomatoes this year because, I was afraid I was going to do it wrong. Or I'm worried about prepping my bed. I've read, five different methods of prepping my bed, and I just don't know which one is the right one, so I didn't do it. And I feel like my message to your listeners is just let all that stuff just compost away in your mind, because really it's about a relationship with the land. And when you get out and you just start planting and you start composting and you start watching, you'll learn what's right for your garden, what's right for you, for the time and energy that you have, for the climate that you have, the soils you have. But you'll never learn any of that from a book. You can only learn it from actually having your hands in the ground. So that was the best advice I ever got was, like people, there's a whole thing about never put your orange peels in your worm bin, and all the things never to put in your worm bin. And there's a lot of, research about that. Well, I'm too lazy to separate out all my compost into a lot of different buckets. And so I've been feeding my worms practically everything for the last 20 years. And my worms are just they're just insane. They're going off. I mean, it's amazing. So that's it. Yeah. That's the best. Don't get paralysis by analysis. Don't talk yourself out of trying something in the garden. Go ahead and try it, because the thing is, things are always changing in the natural environment. Things are always changing in the garden. And if something doesn't work this year, so what? So that's a great learning experience. And then you'll know not to do that again next year. But the act of getting out there and doing it is the first hurdle that we all need to step over.
Gosh, there's so many things I could say here. One lady told me, I asked her about transplanting my irises, and she said, the best time to do it is when you have time to do it. Because I was like, can I do it? You're supposed to do it in the fall. It's spring. I'm so glad I just did it this spring, finally. I wish I would have done all my irises, but I only moved some of them. But the ones that I moved are doing great.
Totally. I love that. Do it when you have the time. That's
and I have
answer.
Had paralysis in other years, and that's why I haven't moved them.
Yeah.
So this year I was like, I'm just going to try it. I'll just move a few. Then I moved a few more. I wish I would have separated them all.
Well, now you know that for next time.
Yeah. Like next year, as soon as they're done blooming, I'm moving as many as I possibly can. Because I feel like those plants grew so much this year. That's like 2 months of growth. Why wait when they're all cramped in that one little bed to the fall?
Right, exactly. And
then the buckwheat
really
thing was an experiment.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad you did that. I mean, sounds like you're going to get the abundance that the buckwheat brings. I mean, one of the things that I tell all my students is the best information you're going to get, the best possible information you can get about your garden is being in your garden and listening to the pattern. If you're in your garden and you see the irises are all cramped and having a hard time, like that's the message it's telling you. It's saying, hey, we want to be separated out.
I swear I can
out.
Hear them. Yep.
Yeah. And so follow your intuition. Follow your gut. Don't let anyone tell you not to do something. If you're in the garden and you have a gut feeling like, gosh, this looks like it really needs to happen, or this is what's calling me, I say go for it, because I don't think there's any better skill a gardener can learn than listening to what the garden is telling you. That is the best skill to cultivate. And that's going to yield the greatest success over time. Because the more you can attune yourself to listening to what the plants and animals are telling you, the more that you actually operate sort of in tandem with the natural world around you.
Well, I could talk to you for hours, but we better stick to the script.
Okay. All right.
So how about a favorite tool? Like if you had to move, is there something you couldn't live without?
The Rogue Hoe. That is a the Rogue is a brand, and it's a special kind of hoe. They make a whole variety of them. I really like.
Is it a scuffle hoe?
Boy, I wish I knew there's a couple of them that are my favorites, but the. I wish I knew I could describe it better to you. There's one that I use that's pretty small, and it comes down at a point. It's not like a regular hoe. It's more like a little scarifier. It comes down at a point, like shaped almost like a...
like a triangle?
Yeah, like a triangle. Exactly. And what I love about that one is... Well, first off, what I love about these hoes is that they are so sturdy. You know, like over the years... I've used so many different hoes, and those heads always fall off, the handles break, it's always rattling around, I'm reattaching the head. It's just like such a pain when you're in the middle of hard work to then have to work, deal with your tool. So these never, ever had an issue like that, ever. After over 20 years of using these Rogue hoes, never had one break, never had a head get loose. The other thing is that they're very, very sharp. And the angle, the way they design the angle of the hoe is just right with the blade of the hoe, that for ergonomic use and productivity and cutting action, it's just nothing beats that. And then I have the one with the triangle head, and that's my main seed prep tool that I use to scarify little depressions in my beds to plant seeds in. And I could plant hundreds of feet of bed very, very fast with that hoe. And then maybe I've many years of use with it too. So, obviously it's kind of a learned thing, but Yeah, those are
Do
my
you have
favorite.
videos of you doing that on your website or anywhere?
Not currently, but that's a good suggestion.
Yeah, I got to say, so this is like the first time I ever heard of that was from Joyce Pinson back in like episode 40 or 70 or something. And she talked about that hoe. And you are not the lots of people have recommended that rogue scuffle hoe.
Yeah.
But, yeah, yeah.
One of my mentors taught me on that. He turned me on to it when I was young, and he taught me on that. And he taught me the Tai Chi of tool use. And that was the tool that we did our Tai Chi tool use with. And I've never went back after that.
Nice. Well, that tools are important. I don't understand. What's Tai Chi of tool use?
It's how you center your gravity. It's like how you, when you use the hoe, you want to have your knees bent and you want to have, you don't want to be like hunched over. You want to have your back straight and your knees bent. And then mm-hmm. as you bring the hoe into motion, you align your breathing with your movement and you're using your entire body. And so all of the power that goes into the hoe isn't really coming from like your arms and your shoulders. It's actually coming from your hip and you're kind of like center of gravity. So it allows you, if you perfect this technique, you can work for many, many more hours without getting tired. And then your body doesn't hurt as much at the end.
You have to make a video of this.
I should make a video of my mentor doing it, actually, because he's the master. But he and I could do it together. Yeah, I'll definitely put that one on the list.
Yeah, because I totally thought you were going to say something completely different. Way back, my first year back from Montana in college, so like 1989, I got this job working on this estate for the governor in New York on Long Island or somebody. And they like taught me how to care for your tools, like oiling the wood and the tool head and putting them away. And like, I thought it was going to be all about that, how to take care of your tools.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Glad
well,
I asked.
That's another level of it too, for sure.
How about, do you have a favorite recipe you like to cook or eat from the garden?
Let me think about that for 1 second. Okay. So on my mom's side, my mom's from Argentina and our family, goes back, generations in Argentina, but also Italy. And so I have a lot of Italian relatives. My grandfather was born in Italy. And one of the recipes that my mom perfected, which is absolutely my favorite, is our family puttanesca sauce. So puttanesca sauce is kind of a spicy Italian sauce. Mm-hmm. Tomatoes, onions, peppers, olives, capers. And so that's absolutely my favorite. And our tomatoes are coming in right now. We've had what we call a foggist, which is sometimes in Northern California, August can be basically all fog every day. And that's the kind of August we've had. So my tomatoes are slow ripening, but I am just waiting for a week of sun to ripen these babies up, and then I want to make my mother's puttanesca sauce.
We're kind of I don't know. Our tomatoes are green. Mike just took all the a lot of the leaf off of one of my plants yesterday, so I'm hoping they're gonna get that sun that I think the trees are shading, because it's been pretty sunny here. Our big thing is getting rid of the smoke. Do you have smoke where you are? I had a friend from California who was here this summer, and she kept saying, it's so smoky in California, you have nothing to complain about.
This has been the smokiest summer, and I've lived in California my whole life. We've never had a summer as smoky as this one. It's a sea change from what's normal. And I mean, we've always had a fire season that usually starts in September, and goes through the end of October. But the fire season started this year in June. So my family and I, we went up to the Sierra Nevadas for vacation. And the whole, that's about 4 hours from where I am now. I'm on the coast. Smoke the whole way. The entire Central Valley, California, covered in smoke. The Sierras, we went up to Lake Tahoe. And part of the beauty of Lake Tahoe is you're on the lake and you see the mountains that surround the lake. Couldn't see any mountains this year. So yeah, it's changed a lot. It's changed the climate here. It's kind of cooled the summer down a little bit because of all the aloft smoke, creates a haze and blocks out some of the sun. So it's been pretty
intense.
That's
what we were having for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on to a better topic. How about a favorite internet resource? Like, where do you like to surf on the web?
Well, I would say for folks who are interested in an amazing plant database, one of the things in permaculture that we do is we design a lot of perennial edible systems. So we use a lot of perennial trees and perennial vegetables and edibles throughout much of our projects. And there's a database that's probably one of the best in the world called Plants for a Future. And
I haven't heard of that.
Oh my goodness. What is so great about that site is that it talks about the ecological function that the plants provide, not only, their growth type and how to care for them and the bloom color and harvest time, but it also tells you if it's a nitrogen fixer or it's a mulch producer or if it's a habitat plant, what kinds of insects that it might attract. So a lot of our designs are really based on choosing plants that not only have a human need, but also provide some sort of ecological function. And that is the best database for that kind of information.
Okay,
so
and then I also want to encourage listeners again to go to your amazing website. Do you want to talk about that a little, like the things that they can find there in detail? Because there was so much to look at. Like I was on my iPad, and like you can follow along one way, but then also if you hit the little menu thing, you get lost over there too. And there's just so much information.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I want to put this up is because you have an advanced water harvesting workshop coming up on September 7th, right? You have all sorts of cool things coming up right away.
Yes, yes. So there's really three websites. There's ericolson.com, there's permacultureskillscenter.org, and there's permacultureartisans.com. So those are the three websites. And we have an advanced rainwater harvesting course happening starting this Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Myself, Brock Dolman, who's an internationally renowned water wizard. Jesse Savo, she's developed an incredible resource called Blue Barrel Systems, and she helps people develop rainwater catchment systems all over the world. So this is an in-person program in Northern California, Spasible, California, and we literally design and build roof water and surface water catchment systems together in the class. So it's not just conceptual, it's hands-on. And this is our third year running it, and we've had wonderful, people love this program.
Is it already full and sold out?
No, it's not sold out. There's definitely
okay.
some space.
Okay, well, if I can get this up today, I will, because like I said, I have a lot of listeners in California, and they might be like, I got to go to that.
No, this is especially for folks in California. We're living in an extended drought, and this is the vital information that any homeowner or gardener really needs in order to have a good relationship with your water and have water abundance. So that's happening this weekend. We have.
You know who I wish would go to that is Bill Maher.
Oh.
He drives me crazy with his ignorance in California. Like I love him, but.
Come on up, Bill. We'll put a tool in Bill's hand. We'll help. He can help us move some tanks around. Yeah, definitely. Well, little by little, we're infiltrating this kind of consciousness is infiltrating at all different levels. There are some celebrities that are totally into permaculture and ecological design and have done amazing things. So there's the water harvesting. We have, I've got some free webinars that you can find at the Permaculture Skill Center. I have a free design webinar, which is basically 2 hours. We get into how to do a professional ecological design. So a lot of my students are folks who want to make a career doing ecological design. Like this is what they want to do for their life, to, you know, provide for their families, is to build ecological landscapes and gardens and farms and restore the environment. And one of the best and most accessible ways to do that is to learn how to be a professional designer, so you can service clients. And I've had clients from cities to counties to nonprofit organizations to schools to private clients, and at all different scales. So it's really fun. You can get into some really juicy projects and literally have this be your career. So I've got this free webinar that you can opt in for at the Permaculture Skill Center website. And then we have our ongoing Eco Landscape Mastery School. We call it the Elm School. And this is an online school that I run where we literally give people all of the tools necessary to run your own ecological design installation company. So all the business systems, templates, how to set up, you know, how to run consultations, how to have a professional design process, and how to work with clients and all that stuff, and how to build community, because a lot of this work is really rooted in building community around this. Like what you're doing with your podcast, you know, it's like inspiring people and bringing people together. And so how do you do that in a professional sense that helps grow and build your business? So we have this school. It's an online program. Every month we have global experts come on to teach us things. Every month I do live coaching calls with my students so people can get one-on-one coaching. And it's just been an amazing journey. It's almost been 1 year since we launched, and people can sign up anytime. The way it's designed, it's like you sign up, you get immediate access to all the modules and all the content, and then you can be there for all the live sessions every month. And then people get access forever. So I have students I've been working with for almost a whole year now, and they're now developing their businesses. They're getting really cool design projects, working with schools and churches, and really starting to provide for their needs, provide for their family, doing this kind of work, regenerating the planet. So you can find out all about that on the Permaculture Skill Center website.
And so is that like a membership thing, or it's like an actual course? Like, do you pay a one-time fee, or you pay a recurring fee, or how does that work?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question. So right now it's set up as a one-time payment, there's also payment plans and scholarships and stuff. But because it's lifetime access, we will probably move to a subscription model maybe in 2019. But right now, we're just keeping it a one-time payment. But you do essentially become a member of an ongoing system of learning, and you get access to all the new content all the time. So because it's in our first year, we're just going to maintain it like this for now. All the first year students get the extra benefits of getting to just pay for it one time.
I like it better that way. But I know a lot of people are into the big subscription thing.
Well, it's from a business model point of view, the subscription thing is good because people only have to pay so much per month, and it feels like more doable that way. Kind of like if you like leased a car, you know, you're paying less. But in the long term point of view, you end up paying more because you have to keep paying to access. So I don't really know which way I like better, because people have a hard time paying the one time fee. And so that becomes a barrier to access. So what is the one-time fee? Well, the whole course is $9.97. That's the typical cost of the program. But We have 50% off scholarships. So if people can't pay that, they can send us a scholarship application. And we take a number of scholarships every month. And then twice a year, we do a 100% scholarship. We have a window where people can, we call it the Equity and Inclusion Scholarship. So twice a year during our big opening, we discount the course $200. And then we offer a number of 100% no charge scholarships for people from, we have students from all over the world. We have folks in Brazil, in the Philippines, in Spain, in South Africa, Europe, all over the United States and Mexico. So we've got a really big diversity and community in there. A lot of folks are real leaders in their community, and others are, you know, developing that for themselves. So we have a lot of different options, and, you know, I always like to work with people to make things work financially and get the right people access who are really going to use the material. So it's really about people engaging us and us finding a way to make it work together. That's the way we're working it right now.
I think that's excellent, though. And, you know, when you pay like a decent price like that, you get a higher quality people that are going to be in the classes with you. You're going to learn more. I think that's totally affordable.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if it's helping somebody build a business that's going to be a livelihood. It's kind of like going to college.
Oh, so much. I mean, and that's the thing, is that we're basically taking the model that I've developed over the last 15 years with my landscape design contracting company. You know, over all the years, we've developed a lot of systems, estimation templates and design templates and all these things, which has really cost us tens of thousands of dollars to develop those systems over the last 15 years. And now students get all of that plus live coaching and lifetime access to it, you know, for $1,000. And then in 1 year, if you applied the system that we provide, folks could easily make, you know, six figures in their first year if they applied everything and you know, and we work with them to help them become successful. You could easily do that in your first year of business if you're you know, ready to do the work. So
yeah, that's always, are you really ready to do all the work? And it's, you might be ready to do the work in the garden, but are you ready to do the business part of it?
Exactly. So different, when you start working with people and social systems, it's a different angle. But what we do is we apply the natural systems thinking, the same principles that we use in the garden, we apply to business and to community. And so it can be really fulfilling and engaging to do this work professionally, because you are really changing people's lives. And you're really connecting people to the earth in meaningful ways and providing solutions for them as well, and helping to provide them with healthy access to healthy food. And so it can be a very fulfilling if you're willing to do the work. But because that course is very specific to people who want to do this work as professionals, one of the programs we have coming on soon is we have a regenerative agroforestry course. And that's an online course with one of my friends and mentors, Penny Livingston Stark. She's the director of the Regenerative Design Institute. And she's been doing permaculture for over 30 years around the world. And so that's going to be a smaller, much more accessible from a financial point of view program that is going to teach folks all about regenerative agroforestry systems, which are essentially agricultural tree systems. And so I would, you know, encourage listeners to look for that, because we're hopefully going to launch that this fall. And I'm really, really excited, because Penny is amazing. She's an amazing teacher. She has amazing stories and amazing knowledge. And I think it's going to be a game changer for the community.
Excellent. Well, I actually love both of those. I know a lot of my listeners, though, are people that are like interested in starting businesses. And most people always talk about, you know, the farmer's market, gardener's market, you know, selling for a CSA. But I think this offers a really nice option for people.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is you know, it takes a bit of literacy that I try to help people realize that when you work as a professional designer, that doesn't mean that you're just designing. That's not landscape architecture. Some people think, oh, if I'm a professional landscape designer, then I'm just designing like hardscapes and patios and arbors and stuff. That's not true at all. I've had plenty of clients over the years where I was literally designing a commercial organic farm. You know, I've designed three or four of those over the years, or I'm designing people's organic homestead gardens. I mean, homesteads are, people are really moving back to the land and they don't know what to do. And they need professional advice on, you know, where do I put my orchard? Where do I put my vegetable garden? How do I keep it watered? You know, all these things, people really struggle, and they probably come on and listen to your podcast to get inspiration and information. Mm-hmm. But as organic gardeners, when we professionalize that service to our community, there's a market for that. And you can do all the fun stuff, designing all the beautiful gardens and all that through that process. But then you actually get paid to do it. And the profit margins are, I would say, much more consistent than, you know, selling your stuff at the farmer's market.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I love all of this. This is so excellent.
Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to come on and share all this with you all.
Yeah, I knew you were going to be a great guest. All right, so we're like breaking an hour and a half, so we better get to the last couple of questions.
Okay.
What's your favorite, do you have like a favorite book or reading material you can recommend to listeners? Magazine or something? Blog?
Well, right now, the book that I am just starting to devour is called The Carbon Farming Solution by Eric Toensmeyer. And this is a book about agricultural solutions to sequester atmospheric carbon. And it is amazing. He has done the research. He has the science backing it up. He's a great writer. It's very inspiring. And I've just been devouring that. So that's the one. That book is currently open on my dining room table because I'm just devouring it. So, yeah, that would
be. Is it like very scientific, like technical, or like can the average layperson read it?
The average layperson can totally read this. It's technical enough. It's technical enough and cited enough that you can feel the authority of the information. But it's written in a way that you can totally digest and understand what he's talking about.
Nice. Because that's like everybody keeps talking about that. That's like really big right now.
Yeah, it's huge.
Okay. Well, we already kind of went through the business advice. How about, here's my final question. It's kind of a doozy.
Okay, doozies. I love doozies.
If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Well, for me, that would be global warming. And I think that we are seeing the results both from an environmental catastrophe and a social catastrophe. Having our wildfire season start in June should be a huge wake-up call to the kind of future that we're entering into now in terms of the global climate. And even the California fire, Cal Fire, even the leadership in Cal Fire came out this year and said, we are on the front lines of climate change. Like, we are on the front lines. And my community that got hit by the fires last year, I literally have friends that are now climate refugees because their homes have been burned to the ground and they can't afford to live here anymore. So I think whether it's that, you know, or all the other aspects of this what's happening around the world. I think this is the most serious situation that we're facing. And because it affects our economy, our culture, our means of production, I feel that if we use this as a lens for designing a new regenerative culture, a new regenerative economy, that would be the focus. And that's why we started the Eco Landscape Mastery School, because one of the clear issues that we face is that we need to move into an economy that is focused on restoring Earth's ecosystems, on building soil, on catching water, on enhancing habitat, and on sequestering carbon. And we currently have a global economy that is extractive and destructive. And so if you think about how our economy can evolve over the next decades, we really pretty much have to move into a more restorative economy, an economy built on taking care of our ecosystems and our communities. And so that's why we started the Eco Landscape Mastery School, was because we know that there's a big gap there in terms of people even having access to learn how to create careers regenerating the planet. And I feel like that's what needs to be one of our focuses. It's not enough for organic gardening to just be a hobby anymore. You know, it's not enough that growing your own food is just something you do when you have time. We have to find a way to make this legitimate and relevant to the mass populace in ways that is actually meaningful for their needs. And that's really where the economy comes into play, to create a regenerative economy that can heal the land and heal our communities at the same time.
You are so eloquent. This is just fantastic. And I feel so much that way. Like this summer, I've been like, I almost feel like my blood's been boiling. Literally, like when the smoke was, like I could feel it in my veins. Because I'm like, why aren't people like completely freaking out? And somebody called Mike an alarmist or an extremist. They're like, he's been saying this for 25 years. I'm like, yeah, and now it's here. We're seeing it.
It's the ultimate I told you so. And you don't want to have to say it. You don't want to have to be like, I told you so. But the same thing with Roundup glyphosate. We've been fighting Monsanto and the application of glyphosate in our agricultural, in our schools, in our cities, on our streets, in agriculture for the last 20 plus years. We've been making this fight. And finally, the science comes out. Oh, actually, this does cause cancer. Oh, this is in, you know, in California right now, they tested every wine in California, right? California is like wine country. Every wine, including organic wines that got tested, had traces of Roundup in it. So much of our organic food, our processed food that is even organic, has found traces of Roundup in it. So this is another one of those things where it's like, it's difficult because we've been calling it out all these years, and now all of a sudden, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost, and it's like, I told you so. Same thing with the climate situation. But we can't get into that. We have to just focus on solutions and bring people to the table and say, well, hey, this is happening. Now let's deal with it together, across cultural divides, across religious beliefs, across political ideologies. It doesn't really matter. Like, I don't ever care about anyone's ideology anymore. That's what's so beautiful about the garden, is that everybody can and should have access to healthy food and should be have time to be in nature and revel in the beauty of our world. It doesn't matter who you are. And so that's why I think this is the solution, is things like your podcast here. And like what we do with our permaculture organizations is unify people around food, unify people around the land, and then we can really get into scaling solutions globally.
Yeah, because actually I got in those arguments with people because they're like, well, there's nothing we can do. We can't do anything. There's going to be a fire. So I love that you're teaching people and hopefully teaching people that kids are going to go to school if somebody learns how to design for a school or a church or the places that you're talking about.
Oh, exactly. We can interface on any cultural institution. I mean, at my kid's school, we built a whole water harvesting, erosion control, edible garden that I designed And that we're in the process of building at their school, and we're basically turning their whole school into a huge edible garden. And a lot, and they can talk about math through there. They can talk about history through the garden. They can talk about science through the garden. You know, it actually fits
writing.
Into a lot of curriculum standards. Writing, you can write about it. I mean, it fits into all the curriculum standards. Why not get kids out of the classroom onto the land at school and make these connections for them, because they're the future and this is the world they're inheriting. And these are vital, important skills that that we need in our world.
Okay, tell everybody how to get in touch with you.
Okay, let's see. Well, there's if you go to permacultureskillscenter.org, you can find all the contact info there. There's also a chat box there that people can click just on the website on any page. There's a little chat box. I get those messages, so people can go directly there. People can send me an email. I'm open to that at Eric, E-R-I-K, at ericolson.com. That's ericolson.com. So ericolson.com is my email. Check out the website. Let us know if you have any questions or inspirations, and we hope to build community and support people's projects around the world.
All right. Well, I'm going to try to like turn this off, post it, and get it out there, because this was just a great day and conversation.
Oh, I had such a great time. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, thank you. Sorry it went so long. Hey, everyone. So I just want to remind you that we created a Patreon page. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And you just go to patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. You can donate $8 per episode, which would hopefully get me back to 2 fresh episodes a week. And I know that you've learned from this podcast. I know it gives out great value. And so if you want to see it keep going and share it with other people, I could really use your help just paying the basics. You know, it cost me at least $100 to keep this show up on the internet for hosting and the website and the calendar and just all the things that help keep it going together. There's also the Green Future Grower Book Club, if you're interested in joining that, for $10 a month, which would be amazing. We're going to go through books like the Elia Coleman, New Organic Gardener, or Jean Martin Fortier's Market Gardener book, or Lisa Ziegler's Cool Flowers. There's the John Jevons book, the Floret, or Lynn Bazinski's flower books. Like, I already love the humus one. I think I'll do a much better job with this study group. So once a month, we'll be picking a different book and we can talk about how it relates to your garden. Only $10 a month to join that. We'll meet on a Zoom or a Google Hangout, and it will be just an amazing extended learning section. So I know I haven't done much to promote this, but please support our Patreon page at patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. That's patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. Hey there, Green Future Growers. Would you like your friends and neighbors to create an organic oasis too? Would you like others in your area to learn about earth-friendly practices for their gardens and yards? If so, we would love it if you would share the Organic Gardener podcast with your local community or college radio station today. Thanks again for listening, and remember, grow local.